Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents War at Sea, a shipwrecked history from antiquity to the 20th century, by James P. Delgado, narrated by Kyle Tate. Preface. My interest in archaeology began with a fascination of ancient people and how they lived. My earliest work, in my native California, was with the sites of the indigenous Ohlone culture in my hometown, and then the California Gold Rush and the role ships played in shaping San Francisco and my home state. As a young man coming of age during the Vietnam War, I'll also admit that I was wary of the military and did not have a powerful interest in military history. That changed when I served in the National Park Service, or NPS, as maritime historian, and worked for Chief Historian Edwin C. Bars. A member of the 3rd Marine Raider Battalion, Ed fought at Guadalcanal, the Russell Islands, and New Britain, where he was grievously wounded. In 1954, he joined the NPS and began his decades-long career with the service. And when I joined his staff in 1987, it was to work on a then-new partnership between the NPS and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, for the wreck of the Civil War ironclad USS Monitor. As the maritime historian of the NPS, I also toured the United States to study ships, sites, and wrecks worthy of designation as national landmarks, and participated in maritime archaeological projects, which included work at Pearl Harbor. Over the course of 4 years, I toured every state and every maritime and naval museum, and dived on many wrecks, inspired and supported by Ed, who made it clear that I could not study, preserve, or understand unless I did these things. "You can't understand a battlefield unless you walk it," he said. So it came to pass that I spent those 4 years immersed in maritime and naval history, whether afloat or underwater. I explored sealed-off compartments, dark passageways, and cold boiler flats, and spent long hours in the archives or museum storerooms. All of these gave me a unique opportunity to explore frigates, submarines, battleships, destroyers, and carriers, as well as PT boats, tugs, and landing craft. My experiences on land, in the archives and museums, and aboard the surviving warships, made distant battles of the past more personal. But what made the connection, and made me focus increasingly on ships of war, was the time I spent with veterans. The first assignment that brought home this point was my interviews with veterans of the Pacific Theater of World War II, particularly American and Japanese survivors of Pearl Harbor. Logbooks, muster rolls, reminiscences, and faded photographs brought into focus battles from their memories rather than from physical remains. But by far my most intense experiences came beneath the sea as an archaeologist. Famous and forgotten ships, types of vessels and weapons otherwise glimpsed in photographs, paintings, or in models, and the physical reality of the battlefield added to my education and to my enthusiasm, and also revealed that archaeology can give voice to the dead in a way that even survivors cannot. Diving on these ships and learning their stories carries a responsibility along with the privilege. The responsibility is to bring forth the images and stories and share them. I have been fortunate to meet and work with a large number of colleagues from around the world who have also explored lost warships. Many of us collaborated to create the British Museum Encyclopedia of Underwater and Maritime Archaeology. The exchanges with my colleagues, as well as the undeniable fascination of simply seeing some of these submerged warriors and their battlefields, were the inspiration for an earlier book, Lost Warships. Lost Warships was not intended to be a comprehensive review of war at sea, nor a detailed accounting of the development of the warship through history. It was neither full of the technical specifications for these ships, nor a blow-by-blow accounting of sea battles. It was intended for a wider audience of divers, students of the past, and those interested in the saga of war at sea. Nearly 2 decades have passed since I wrote Lost Warships. War at Sea is much more than a rewrite of Lost Warships. The last 2 decades have seen an exponential growth in the number of warship discoveries, and even as I write this at the end of 2017, one of the last enduring mysteries of World War II at sea, the final resting place of the USS Indianapolis, the cruiser that delivered the atomic bomb to Tinian, and the famous carrier USS Hornet, have been found. With colleagues, I am working on new expeditions that may imminently yield even more amazing findings in the deepest parts of the ocean. After I wrote Lost Warships in 1999, I spent 6 years working as the traveling and diving archaeologist and host of National Geographic International's television show, The Sea Hunters, in which I participated in and led expeditions to a number of lost warships, some of them only then recently discovered. None of those wrecks we dived, other than Kublai Khan's lost fleet, were featured in Lost Warships. Since then, archaeology has revealed a vastly larger site and hundreds of new finds. This is one example of many in which the archaeological study of warships has grown in the last 2 decades. Adding to these new finds are amazing new developments that have emerged from ongoing excavations and laboratory analysis of finds from sites like the ongoing study of the massive collection of artifacts from the 1628 wreck of Vasa, the raised turret of the USS Monitor, or the interior of the raised Confederate Civil War submarine H.L. Hunley. War at Sea retains some of Lost Warships, but it is a substantially different, new book. Since I wrote Lost Warships, another great shift in terms of the loss of living memory came, as the last veterans of World War I passed away. What is now happening is the passing of the last generation to fight an extended war at sea during World War II. Those veterans who remain are in their 90s. They will soon all be gone, as distant to younger generations as those who fought in the Spanish-American War were to mine. Also striking is the loss of shipwrecks, not only as these sites are trawled away as fishing grounds expand, but also, shockingly, as artifacts are stolen off the seabed by modern salvagers who care nothing of these wrecks as graves or as historic and archaeological sites. This is highlighted not only off the coast of Europe with World War I wrecks, but in the Pacific. The wrecks of the Battle of the Java Sea, 1942, the British heavy cruiser HMS Exeter, the Dutch light cruisers HNLMS Java and HNLMS De Ruyter, the Australian light cruiser HMAS Perth, the British destroyers HMS Electra, HMS Encounter, HMS Jupiter, and the Dutch destroyer HNLMS Kortenauer were discovered between 2002 and 2008, but subsequently were illegally salvaged. The U.S. Navy's lost submarine, USS Perch, also sunk in the Java Sea, has also been salvaged and destroyed. This is not the looting of a treasure ship for its gold. Here, the illegal salvage is literally of entire ships for their bulk steel. Left behind are scant traces, or nothing at all, in one of the most shocking recent developments in the history of sunken warships. I hope the sections that follow convince you why we must preserve and study these wrecks. Through them, we have learned and can continue to learn the lessons they can teach us about war. This is true especially as these ships and the spaces within them provide eloquent physical testimony about not just the ships, but of life and death, and a sense of those who went down with them. Through the archaeology of lost warships, the dead can indeed tell tales. James P. Delgado. Introduction. Earth's Greatest Battlefield. From space, the view of Earth leaves no doubt that this is a water planet. Water dwarfs the land masses, large as they seem to a landlubber's perspective. One great ocean washes all those shores, and though it bears many names, Mediterranean, Baltic, Indian, Pacific, and Atlantic, it covers most of the Earth. The sea has defined our history since the beginning of human endeavor, when we first built ships. The sea is the source of our life and the connective thread of our commerce. Millennia of war at sea have left a lasting trace in thousands of ships that in many cases are the graves of countless tens of thousands of men. Other than memory, how do we remember and commemorate these ships, these men? These battles. The battlefields of the ocean are a vast, unmarked grave. No monuments stand on patches of water marked only by coordinates on a chart. The sea rarely gives up the dead. To honor the living and the dead, we occasionally return to those battlefields to speak of sacrifice and determination, or to silently toll the bell and toss wreaths into the dark sea. We erect monuments on land, like Nelson's Column in Trafalgar Square, the USS Maine Memorial at Arlington, and a score of other statues and cenotaphs around the world. We save and memorialize surviving warships. By far the greatest number of preserved historic ships in the world's museums are warships. For those who did not serve, some sense of what it was like is conveyed by the reality of the armor, the guns, the cramped quarters, and the written word, the oral history, the photographs, paintings, or films of those rapidly retreating times, the stories behind the physical artifacts. Some of those stories are reminiscences, as well as the analytical work of historians. In more modern times, motion pictures have offered imagery of row galleys at ramming speed, ships of the line hammering at each other with broadsides, battleship salvos, carrier battles, World War II submarines running silent and deep, and high-speed cat-and-mouse battles of skill by Cold War submariners. War at sea is a powerful subject, rich in history, imagery, and emotion. It should come as no surprise that all of these books, songs, and films, these museum ships resting peacefully at the dock, or the displays of paintings and memorabilia in galleries, do not satisfy our need to remember, commemorate, and touch the past. That is why, over the past several decades, divers, underwater explorers, and archaeologists have ventured into the deep in search of lost warships. I personally know the allure, for I am one of them. History comes alive when you enter those dark compartments. I felt it, after sharing memories with survivors and then dropping down through the water to see firsthand what they've talked about. I'm not alone. That is why millions of viewers watch televised specials or live internet-based exploration of these wrecks. That is why archaeologists raise artifacts and entire ships, like the Swedish galleon Vasa and Henry VIII's carrack Mary Rose, to share with non-diving museum visitors. This book is a review of what archaeologists have learned about lost warships, battles on the water, and the life and death of those caught up in those conflicts. A tour, if you will, through an imaginary museum of underwater archaeology. Many of these wrecks, and their stories, have been featured in the popular media. The stories of Vasa, CSS Hunley, USS Monitor, USS Arizona, Mary Rose, the Needham ship, or the lost Mongol fleet of Kublai Khan are just some of the warships to surface in the public eye through television or in the pages of magazines like Naval History or National Geographic. For most people, the stories often end there, fading away into the background of our fast-paced digital world. But for archaeologists and other students of the past, archaeology is more than just the discovery. Archaeology, the careful scientific recovery and study of the past, is 2 centuries old. Archaeology beneath the sea dates only to the 1960s. Over the past few decades, thousands of shipwrecks have been discovered, and a few hundred have been documented, excavated, and recovered by archaeologists. Some sank in storms or by accident. Others were sent deliberately to the bottom, blasted to a watery grave with their crews. They range in age from ancient row galleys that sank one another with huge bronze rams at their wooden bows, to modern steel ships sunk by aircraft, missiles, or nuclear weapons. In studying these lost warships, archaeologists learn many things. Older wrecks may provide us with a detailed sense of what these ships actually looked like. Newer wrecks may provide a closer picture of an actual battle. In the chapters that follow, I hope you hear how little we actually know about many warships, from ancient times through the medieval period. In a number of cases, archaeologists and naval historians are reconstructing warships from paintings, sculptures, images on coins, models from tombs, and descriptions from ancient literature. Oftentimes, that is not enough. You need the actual wreck of the ship. Otherwise, it's all a fair amount of guesswork. Many discussions and occasional controversies often dominate the field of nautical archaeology over the size of certain ships, the arrangement of oars, decks, and the construction of the hull, not to mention tactics and how battles actually would have unfolded. Nautical archaeologists in particular are interested in how ships were built and worked, and specifically how different they were from merchant ships built to carry passengers or cargo. Changing technology of armament and propulsion influenced the design of warships, as did the availability of materials. Oftentimes, changes did not happen progressively or uniformly around the world. Contrary to most history books, the Chinese adopted gunpowder weapons, the rudder, armor, and paddle wheels long before Europeans did. While the Mediterranean powers continued to focus on oar-powered warships, northern Europeans were building larger ocean-going sailing ships that developed into platforms for guns, which was the genesis of the famous galleon. The physical evidence from the sea provides a better picture of when certain developments occurred, such as the introduction of guns. It also gives us a better physical sense of the very sophisticated, often intricately developed methods of construction employed by the architects of warships. The carefully engineered bow of an ancient warship, built to withstand the shock of ramming another ship, or the methodical reinforcing of an early multi-decked galleon to carry the weight of the guns, remind us that our ancestors were at least as clever as we are today. Wrecks like the famous Vasa or Mary Rose, both of which capsized and sank, killing most of their crews, also remind us that some of those lessons of warship design were learned through harsh trial and error. Archaeology is a tool used to study people and their behavior. Individuals and societies under stress often make choices that are revealing about themselves and their circumstances. The archaeology of warships often shows how ships can be built quickly, under exigent circumstances, to respond to a crisis. Years of tradition are discarded in times of strategic vulnerability. Technology leaps forward. Certain types of ships are found to be more efficient, hence more construction of carriers, submarines, and destroyers during World War II than giant battleships. Shortcuts not acceptable in peacetime, such as ships built out of green, unseasoned timber, or the rapid acceptance of all welded as opposed to riveted construction, arise from wartime emergencies. There are also examples of recycling. These are warships that are practically rebuilt under the guise of repair in fiscally strapped times. There is also the difficult and labor-intensive salvage of ships that would be written off in peacetime, while allowing them to be repaired and pressed back into service in wartime. All of these speak volumes about human nature. Anthropologist Richard A. Gould has spent much of his career studying the social history of ships and what they reveal about us as a species. The response to new technologies and the misapplication of those technologies is a particular interest of his. The 19th century introduction of armor, steam engines, and shell-firing guns changed warships and naval warfare. But in some cases, such as the rise of the battleship, the efforts and energies expended were largely wasted. Battleships, for the most part, did not function, fight, or die as the tacticians and designers intended. In the 100 years that spanned the mid-19th and mid-20th centuries, 650 battleships were built. They were designed for ship-to-ship sea battles. But only 16 were sunk as a result of this type of action. In this, Gould sees a consistent misapplication of new technologies to naval tactics. How this happened, and why, is a question he has examined. The answers are complex and perhaps debatable. Tactical indecision, confusion over what a new technology really means, the need to integrate a new technology even before all the implications are known or tested, the always fascinating difference between theory and practice, and the need to match a foe's developments, weapon for weapon, all play a part. What is perhaps most important is how these wrecks speak to us about people. In the stories that follow, I hope that you, the listener, come away with a better understanding not only of the times and cultures that produced these ships of war, but of the people who built, lived in, fought in, and died in these ships. There are two themes in particular that I'd like to address. The first is our propensity as humans to use violence as a means to an end. In a number of these cases, the ships and sites you are about to visit speak to this problematic aspect of our nature. Some ships were built to project power and inflict violence. Others were built to defend against those who would come by sea to take, to impose, or to harm. The second is that in many cases, and particularly in any future, in ages where empires, nations, rulers, or causes have faded into the history books, These shattered ships contain within them, whether figuratively or literally, those who were lost with them. While there are, and will always be, fervent adherents to an ideology, patriots who fight for love of country, and those who follow the drumbeats of war, there are others who go fight and die, because like so many in history, they were caught up in something bigger than themselves, and in events over which they as individuals had no choice. 1. Beginnings. As for those assembled on the sea, they were dragged, overturned, and laid on upon the beach, slain, and made heaps from stern to bow of their galleys, while all their things were cast into the water. Ramesses III, Pharaoh of Egypt, 1190 BC. Human civilization is only possible because of water. Water provides sustenance for people and crops, and is a rich and diverse source of food when harvested. Even now, in the 21st century, more than half of the world's food comes from the ocean. How long have humans turned to the sea for food? Archaeologists suggest that we began gathering nearshore shellfish as far back as 165,000 years ago. But when did humans build our first boats and take to the open water? When did organized warfare begin? And when did it take to the water? Evolutionary biologist Eduardo Moreno of the University of Bern has proposed, based on DNA evidence, that a more belligerent group of people migrated out of Africa some 80,000 years ago, and that this tribe of warriors, using weapons and big war canoes, traveled the coasts and up big rivers to expand and, if necessary, raid and conquer. It's a fascinating thought, and as Moreno notes, this warfare culture may have given the out-of-Africa migrants a competitive advantage to colonize the world, but it could also have crucially influenced the subsequent history of the Earth. Some of the oldest evidence of human seafaring comes from East Timor, off the north coast of Australia, where 42,000 years ago, we know ancient peoples took to the seas on voyages that took them offshore and back to port. That's not so surprising when you consider that the ancestors of Australia's Aboriginal people crossed the ocean to reach Australia 3,000 years earlier than that. Although some scientists argue that those people, crossing about 18 miles of open water, may have simply drifted there on rafts. Recently, the excavation of the cave known to locals as Jeremiah found solid evidence of advanced maritime skills, lead archaeologist Susan O'Connor told Science magazine in 2011. At least in terms of fishing, O'Connor said, people had these skills 42,000 years ago, because her team found the bones of deep-sea fast fish, namely sharks and tuna, in the layers left inside the cave by generations of occupants. O'Connor's team also found a fish hook made from a mollusk shell that has been scientifically dated to 23,000 years ago. Some archaeologists argue that the evidence is not conclusive enough to argue for ancient peoples taking to the sea in boats as far back as that. The oldest boats found by archaeologists go back some 10,000 years, and they are logboats and canoes. But canoes, lashed to outriggers, can become seafaring craft capable of crossing great distances and safely transporting people. The best-known example of that is the Polynesian voyaging canoe. Without getting much further down this rabbit hole, let's also remember that the human brain reached the level of behavioral modernity, as paleoanthropologists term it, about 80,000 years ago. And by 60,000 years ago, people were fanning out from Africa throughout the globe. By 36,000 years ago, based on finds in caves, people were making musical instruments. We'd invented art that is striking, spiritual, and sophisticated. We were trading with one another, and we were burying our dead with ritual and care. Were we taking to the sea? I'm going to go out on a limb here and say yes. We just have not found those earliest sites because some 11,700 years ago, the most recent great ice ages ended, and over the next few thousand years, as the glaciers melted, the sea rose some 100 meters, drowning most of humanity's coastal settlements. The evidence of early human seafaring, for the most part, now lies beneath the sea. In the place where people meet, trade, and work, especially in a quest for resources, conflict arises. Some of the earliest seafaring, therefore, had to involve sending warriors by water to fight, or encountering and fighting another group on the water. The earliest evidence of larger-scale human warfare excavated, dated, and analyzed by archaeologists is a 10,000-year-old site called Nataruk, near Lake Turkana, Kenya. There, at a coastal settlement on the edge of a now dried-up lagoon, at least 27 people, six of them children, and one of them a late-term pregnant woman, had been shot with arrows multiple times and beaten with enough force to break bone, and then left in the shallows, unburied. Archaeologist Marta Mirazón-Lar, who co-led the excavation, noted that the attack appeared premeditated and initiated from afar, based on the stone of the projectiles and the victim's wounds. Why were they massacred? Lar believes the attackers were after the resources that the people of Nataruk had that were valuable and worth fighting for, such as dried meat or fish, nuts, water, or women and children. There may be earlier sites, I will argue, that also lie at or near now drowned Ice Age coastal settlements. War by, and perhaps on water, goes back a long way, whether you agree with Moreno at 80,000 years, or with Lar at 10,000 years ago. War canoes. The oldest and longest-lasting warships are war canoes. Canoes span the world's cultures. They include inland watercraft used on rivers and lakes, as well as on the ocean. This earliest form of watercraft goes back millennia. Canoes were ideal not only for transporting people and commodities, but also for warfare. Whether or not canoes in the distant past included types specifically devoted to war probably varied with the beliefs of specific cultures. In the Americas, early European observers noted that larger canoes ordinarily used for transport could, when the time came for a raid or war, be specially blessed and painted with symbols for war. As humanity's oldest craft, it has perhaps been easy for later cultures and groups to deem canoes primitive craft. They were nothing of the sort. In West Africa, war canoes up to 25 meters long were used to fight battles on inland lakes, rivers, and along the coast. African accounts of fights on the water went back centuries and continued through the 19th century. There are numerous European accounts of African war canoes, with African rulers amassing war fleets, and in response to the arrival of the Europeans, adapting to new weapons. One account offers a vivid description of how 8 canoes, armed with European guns, attacked 2 Dutch trading canoes on the Benin River in 1716. These canoes belonged to and were crewed by Ijaw people of the Niger River Delta. Reportedly, a Gatling gun mounted in a canoe was used by the Ijaw in the Kalabari Civil War of 1879 to 1883. On the northwest coast of the United States and Canada, the intricate waterways of the Inside Passage and Puget Sound were home to diverse and often warring groups of maritime peoples who used their canoes to raid one another for slaves and commodities, or for revenge, and to engage in wars of territorial expansion. These craft, according to ethnographer David Mitchell, ranged from 20 to 24 meters in length. They were formidable, especially when packed with up to 100 armed warriors. Early European explorers and fur traders on the northwest coast respected, if not feared them, particularly when some of the early European and American ships on the coast were small and carried smaller crews. The islands of Haida Gwaii, on the British Columbia and Alaska border, were the setting for dozens of attacks on, and 6 seizures of, fur trading ships from 1789 to 1854. The Haida, known to some as the Vikings of the North Pacific, built some of the greatest of these canoes, carving each one from a single cedar log. With high prows, usually adorned with the crest of the chief who owned them, these head canoes were used for war. When that happened, the crests were removed as the canoes were stripped for battle. A bear crest from the prow of a Haida war canoe now in the collection of the Canadian Museum of Civilization is an evocative and powerful example. The museum also has a 17-meter-long Haida war canoe carved in 1904 by famed artist Charles Edenshaw. Another 19-meter-long example, also probably carved by Edenshaw, is displayed at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. They are the only known survivors of a once vast and feared type of warcraft. By the same token, the oceanic canoes of the Pacific engaged in voyages of exploration, colonization, and then...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?